Stay tuned until the end of this episode for an exclusive announcement.
Survivor's Guide to True Crime includes discussions of sexually based violence and is not intended for children. Information provided should not be used as a substitute for professional medical or legal advice. Please exercise discretion and self-care.
Welcome back to Survivor's Guide to True Crime. I'm Kim.
And I'm Kara.
Thanks so much for joining us again this week. We are happy to have you back.
It's been kind of a crazy couple of weeks. We've both been up to our eyeballs with stuff, and maybe things are catching up with us a little bit.
I have felt feelings.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I literally texted you Saturday, and I was like, I feel some kind of way.
Yes.
I think that's exactly what I said, right? And I was like, I don't know what I'm feeling because I don't always know how to name my feelings. It takes me a while because I'm so used to literally my entire life of just like shoving them down. And so like naming them, it's damn near impossible for me, to be quite honest. And so Kim said, what did you say?
So this is actually a trick that I have learned from child therapists. I said, okay, you don't know what the name is. What color are your feelings? And it sounds really silly, but at the same time, like there's some serious psychology to this. So I said, what color are you feeling?
And I said purple because it was like equal parts red and blue. So like sad, I guess, and angry, like irritated.
And he said black.
And I also said black because I was like, but I also don't want to feel anything. I started out with white and I was like, that's too. I was like, because I was like blank slate, flat affect. Mm-hmm. I think that I kind of lean towards flat affect whenever I get very overwhelmed with emotions, but it fluctuates between that and like blackout, like run away, don't feel anything, disconnect from everyone, hide in a cave. And so I was like, I don't know where all of this is coming from. Usually I can pinpoint things where it's like, oh, I just overshared, or I've been doing a lot of work sharing my story, or my kids are difficult, or like there's always something that I could identify, but I did not have anything that I could identify as like what was the switch that flipped for me. And so we kind of talked through it, and I literally was sitting on the floor in the gym because I was trying to work out and I just felt terrible. And I was like, I'm not even about to start my period. I like, because Kim's always like, are you about to start your period?
No. Well, no, but not in a mean way. It's like, I know that this is, it's a bad damn time.
Exactly. And so I was like, I don't know what's wrong with me. I just feel weepy. Like I cried watching a video on TikTok that morning. I didn't even tell you this part. I was I know. Listen to what made me cry. I figured it out later, but it was a video of this woman. She had a service dog and she was like taking a video of her training the dog.
Okay. Yes.
Okay. So she's like training him in Harris Teeter or whatever. So she just like has the camera set down and he's a seizure detection dog. Mm-hmm. And she has a seizure in the video. Oh, and I'm sobbing. And I was like, why is that making me cry? Well, come to find out, the reason I was upset is because I felt really lonely. And I think the video made me cry because I feel lonely. And also, my dog doesn't prefer me anymore. Like, he's like my husband and my son's dog. And so I was like, I'm a service dog, doesn't even. He's not a service dog, y'all. He failed. But I was like, I'm so. But none of that registered. Mm-mm. At all. And what I realized through talking to you is I said, I think I'm feeling lonely. And as I typed those words on my phone, I started pouring tears. And I was like, well, that's it.
And there's the chord that was struck.
That's the one. And I have no reason I should feel lonely. I'm surrounded by amazing people I love and a community. And I have great friends and family. And
the loneliness that you were feeling was a very specific type, because you can be surrounded by love and compassion and people who you trust and care about. And if there is a piece that is so much a part of your heart and your passion and your life
that does not feel seen,
It can still feel that way. So, I mean, honor the fact that you can have both of those things at once, all of those things at once.
Right. And I had just texted you a day or two before, too. And I said, do you ever feel like you're not normal? You can't just be around normal people and have normal conversations. And you were like, all the time. And I sent it to you at like midnight. Which I'm never awake that late. So that's a sign. First of all, something weird's going on with me.
I know. I'm like, it's 7:30 at night here in the lost time zone of Mountain Standard Time. Kara's absolutely asleep. Talk to you tomorrow.
Yeah. So I realized that what I do, what I spend most of my days doing, most of my time doing, it's very lonely work. Because I'm doing it by myself, and the people in my day-to-day life that I interact with, I can't have conversations with them about it. It feels very one-sided when someone asks, like, how is your week at work? And I tell them, I'm like, oh, I've been binging the Girls Next Level podcast, and I'm learning all about all these crazy things that have been happening, you know, or that happened, I guess I should say, in the Playboy Mansion. And I feel so weird. Like, people are just like, what?
Well, I have my very best friends that I've had since college, and we have a group text. And if I'm trying to talk about something you and I are doing or anything podcast wise or just media or advocacy, it's like they're there and cheering and totally in my corner, but you can't get into nuance or anything beyond that because it's just a different world and it feels really isolating at times. Especially for you and I, going through this has been wonderful because it's like, all right, here's our baby that we love and care so much about because it's a piece of our heart. We love this podcast and the two of us can work on it. And outside of that, it feels like we're isolated from the rest of the world.
Yeah. It's like even other people that are podcasters or influencers can't really relate to even people like that. So one of the things that we've been toying around with the idea of is getting a lot of these connections that we've made and these friendships that we've made into one technological space where we can support one another. And I just, once I realized I was lonely and I felt alone, I was like, let me just go ahead and create a community. So all that to say that if you're feeling lonely and you're feeling isolated and you can't figure out why, maybe it's just because you don't have people who understand what you're going through. And I say this, I know every episode at some point because I'm so passionate about it. But that truly is one of the reasons we founded this podcast. Mm-hmm. And loneliness even affects us. Like, even though we have each other and we have these other guests in this community, it's lonely sometimes in a healing journey, being a survivor, being someone who has to fight for themselves and for others. It can be really lonely sometimes.
And it doesn't always have to be those really big things. It doesn't have to be, you know, world-changing advocacy. It can be small stuff just in your day-to-day life that maybe you feel like no one else is quite understanding on your level. We see that a lot between spouses even. Like, you're handling most of the things at home and it is that mental load and that space that someone else who loves you and cares and supports you just can't quite understand. And that in and of itself can feel lonely. So don't discredit if you're feeling that way. It's okay. I would love to have a space if anyone's out there listening that do you want to join our club? I think that would be really fun to have just sort of that group and that community. And so I would be interested to hear, because it's not a Facebook type of discussion, but we were talking about a way for everyone to connect. And even if it's not with me or with Kara, you can still find people who are like-minded that are also listening to this and having those aha moments and wanting to do good in their community. And we think we finally figured out a place where we can all do that, that will benefit the podcast and the guests, and most importantly, all of you as listeners.
Yeah, so we're starting a Patreon. I think that's what you're supposed to do, right?
Is that even how you say it? Like, hello, this is our Patreon.
So we're starting a Patreon, and that will be a space for you guys to get some exclusive content. We'll probably be doing some lives over there, and you get a t-shirt. I spent the morning designing the t-shirt, and I'm just going to say, you need to go look at it. But it is the most epic name. This was the name that we thought about using for the podcast. And we said, nay, it might be a little too controversial. So we reserved it for our Patreon.
We wanted to be taken seriously despite our antics, but I'm so glad that we chose it for the Patreon group because it is perfect. So
yeah,
I cannot wait.
So join the club. You're not going to get a jacket yet.
Yet.
But join the club and you get a t-shirt. It's a really nice, I picked a comfort color shirt. I was trying to sell it to Kim this morning. Basically, it's like, imagine when you get a nice quality thick t-shirt and then it's really broken in, like worn in. So it's a comfort colors t-shirt. It's really comfy, like a higher end t-shirt. And we also have merch just in general. It's on my website and it's the buffalo, our little buffalo. Do you want to tell everybody about the buffalo?
I loved that. When we were going back through and editing and such, every single time I was getting to that part, I was still jaw dropping about Run Towards the Rain. And it has just settled in both of our minds as this mantra, at least for this first season, where we're all going to go through the storm. It's going to get to us no matter what. We might as well run towards the rain and get through it together and as quickly as possible. So I love it. So we got merch. And also, I think a good call to action for all of you, because we are seeing your questions coming in. That's really exciting. And we're saving them all for our Q&A, whether we do that. We'll have an episode here and we're going to do some live Q&As over on the Patreon as well. But we are collecting those questions. Keep sending those in. Another thing that you can do, though, is if you have ideas for exclusive merch that you would like to see, whether it's something that I say, Kara says, one of our guests say, or just an overarching philosophy from the podcast, we want to hear about it. So make sure that you're using our email address. It's hello@survivorsguidetotruecrime.com. All of the letters.
So many letters.
All right, let's get into our episode and our guest. I am really excited to present this conversation to everyone because some of the things that you are about to hear about are the first time that they are going to be discussed publicly. Kara and I have become really great friends with Jess Michaels. She is our guest today, and that is a name that you are going to want to remember and gravitate towards for all things sexual assault prevention and just a powerhouse of a woman and a survivor. And I love how much ownership she takes over her story and reclaiming the narrative that everyone in the world thinks that they somehow now own. But this piece and the things that you are about to hear have the potential to impact a lot of lives.
Yeah, these are going to be names and incidences that you've heard a little bit about, but this is going to be a way that you've not heard of. These names are not going to be unfamiliar to you. So I hope you enjoy this. I hope you consume it with consideration and take into account all of our trigger warnings as always.
Jess Michaels is a dance industry professional with 30 years experience as a performer, educator, and entrepreneur. She's also the 1991 survivor of sexual assault by Jeffrey Epstein and a childhood sexual abuse survivor who was silently tortured for decades by the repressed, unprocessed trauma that destroyed her emotional, physical, and intellectual health. Shockingly, her healing journey began December 14, 2012, after Jess and her hometown of Newtown, Connecticut were devastated by the mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School.
It was there in Newtown, teaching dance classes and working alongside brave parents who lost their children, that Jess began to connect the value of shame-free, community-based early trauma intervention to the needs of sexual assault survivors.
Now, as the founder of Three Joannes, a revolutionary app and sexual assault first responder training that prepares and strengthens community trust, support, and safety, Jessica hopes no one else loses 30 years of their life imprisoned in the wreckage of unprocessed trauma like she did. Here's our conversation with Jessica Michaels.
Jess, thank you so much for joining us. We are so glad you're here today.
Thank you for having me. I am so honored to be here because of the incredible community that you're creating together and just honored to be invited. So thank you for having me.
We're so excited to have you today. Jess and I have had the chance to connect, never in person, unfortunately, which I feel like is very normal at this stage in society, but just the conversations that we have gotten to have were wonderful and time well spent. And I feel like we could have just kept going and going. So naturally, it's time to record one of those. I'm really excited to bring that to all the listeners. We want to kick this off the same way that we do with all of these. Tell us, what is your current binge? What are you watching, whether it's movies, TV, books? What are you binging right now?
I just finished Godless on Netflix. Have you seen that?
No. What is this?
We always learn something new.
I know. It's really good. I'm shocked that it's not in the top 10 for Netflix. It is a story set in the Old West and about a town run by women. And I'll leave it at that.
Okay. All right. Adding to list now.
It's also just a really great story of redemption and love and what brings us together, what takes us, what pulls us apart. And it's beautiful. It's well done. And I'm a horse fan. I love horses. And so some of the cinematography is incredible and the horses are beautiful, and they are actually a part of the story. So it's a beautiful, beautiful piece. Heart-wrenching and beautiful.
You've won me over. I grew up riding horses, and I always grew up with my mom. Anytime we would watch a movie that had horses, she'd be like, oh, look at that horse. It's a blah, blah, blah. And look at how beautiful it is. And so now I do the same thing. And I'm just like, oh my God. Like, we rewatched Legends of the Fall, which I haven't seen in years. And I was reminded of how many gorgeous horses there are in that movie. I was like, there's some beautiful, beautiful equines in that. And humans.
I've never seen Legends of the Fall.
Okay. It's on Netflix. Okay. It's going to make you cry your eyeballs out, probably.
Okay.
Definitely. But it's like OG Brad Pitt, like 90s Brad Pitt, and like heart-wrenching. It's very long, too, but it's so good.
So good. Oh, good. Yay. Thank you.
I don't really remember the last time that I would have watched that movie, or if I've even seen it all the way through before. So might be time.
Well, there we go.
I know.
We'll discuss after, Kim.
Okay. Yeah, so you need to watch it too. And then we'll regroup and then we will discuss.
Brad Pitt and the horses.
Yes, for sure.
I actually got thrown off a horse. I was hunting and was going straight up a mountain, which, you know, shouldn't do. And horse got tired and basically just like collapsed and threw me off into sagebrush. And thankful, I don't know how. I think I was so bundled up and had a backpack on, and it threw me into the brush and it landed on my leg, but not in a way that it broke. I don't have any idea how, but yeah, then I ended up walking like the extra 3.5 miles or whatever.
Oh my gosh.
Just like, hey, horse, you and I are just going for a nice little walk in the woods.
Did you get back on a horse again after that, though? That's the question.
No, I have not. And that
Kimberly!
That's
like rule number one.
Well, it's not like they're just wandering around. We got cows here. I'm not just going to like saddle up, partner.
No, 2023, you know, there's a...
I've been around plenty of them and I love them. But yeah, no, I have not gotten back on the horse, proverbial or literally. So. Whatever. All right. So Jess, I'd like to start off our listeners with you telling your story to your comfort level. Fill us in just on how you got to where you are.
Thank you. So I'm trying to figure out where to start because it's an interesting, bizarre story. But I started out as a professional dancer at 22. And my roommate at the time, I'd met on a job for a cruise ship. She needed a roommate in her apartment in Brooklyn, so she invited me to live with her after our contract. And we both were working off and on throughout that next year, leaving that apartment, coming back to the apartment, leaving the apartment, coming back to the apartment. And so I'd come back from about 6 months away in dancing in Tokyo. I got to dance with MC Hammer. I had modeling agents, acting agents. It was awesome. And I come back and she tells me that she's been working for this wealthy Wall Street guy who was taking her all over the world, training her in massage. And she was loving it, like having this incredible experience of, you know, she said, I'll go off with him to Europe and I'll spend a week there. And maybe I have to do 3 massages, but then I have the rest of the time to myself and I'm making all this money. And he loves dancers and wants to help dancers and artists because he can. And she was leaving to go out of town. So I want to back up for a second, also explain some things to people that don't understand about dancers. So we work on each other all the time. We work on each other's muscles. If you walk into a professional dance studio, you will see dancers spread all over the floor. Half of them are putting a leg up over their head on the wall. The other half are massaging someone's hip or their feet. I mean, we're really comfortable in our bodies and we're really comfortable working on each other's bodies. And so this for my roommate and I both seemed like the perfect scenario, the perfect opportunity for someone like a dancer. And so she told me he doesn't want to work with professionals because he has a very specific way of teaching. And he's traveled all over the world. So he has these international techniques that are incredible. And so there was a point where I'm jealous. I'm jealous because she's allowed to go to auditions anytime she wants. She's traveling all over the world making all this money. So I think she's landed the perfect job for a working dancer. So she's going out of town and she says, do you want to meet him? Because, you know, he's going to need somebody as a backup because I got this job and he's going to need somebody to work with him while I'm gone. And I think, oh my God, this is amazing. And so I had the opportunity to meet him in July of 1991, was invited to his office. And it's really, I think, a fascinating look back at grooming and manipulation. I'm told, you know, to see this person, go to this address, that person lets me into his office. And initially when I see the office, it does not look like the office of a millionaire. In fact, the desk looks like one of those metal school teacher desks when I first see it. And what I found really fascinating was that when I sat down and he's asking me all these questions and they're detailed about, you know, anatomy and nervous systems and how the body works and all these different techniques. In that conversation, I was shocked. I didn't know as much about the body as I thought that I did. And he seemed disappointed and thought, well, I don't know if this is going to work or not, but if you want to study this, you know, he has me come around the desk and he opens up a drawer. And in that drawer, there is about a dozen books called The Book of Massage. And he says, you know, study this and we'll see how it goes. So he did what in sales would be called the takeaway. Like, you don't really, I don't know if this is going to work and you may not make it. So being the overachieving dancer that I was and human that I am, what did I do? I go out and I buy a 5-subject notebook and I take that book and I study it for a week as hard as I can, like thinking to get this job. I still have that notebook, by the way. So the roommate tells me the next day or so, you know, Jeffrey liked you. And I think that's great. And he said, okay, call him next week after you've had some time with the book. So that week, I give a call to his office. He asks me to come to his penthouse, July 9th, 1991. It's a penthouse building. And so when I get there, the doorman has to actually go to the elevator and let me up to get into the penthouse. And for the very first time, I see what this wealth looks like. The door opens to the apartments. And I go past this divider and there's a sunken-in living room and windows that open up to all of New York City. And it's very overwhelming in the moment of just how lush and gorgeous it is. Something living in a Brooklyn brownstone, you know, studio apartment, something I had not seen before. So in that moment, I knew he was wealthy. And me and my little notebook gets there, 22-year-old dancer, and thinking, not only am I going to get this job, but I want to show him that I'm smart. So when he comes out in a white bathrobe. And I ask him right off the bat, so why do you hire dancers to do a massage when clearly you could afford to hire professionals? And he says, oh, he's like, dancers, you know, they know the body better than massage therapists. Appealing to my ego. Dancers have the best bodies. Dancers take care of themselves. I mean, you wouldn't want a fat personal trainer, would you? And it was in that moment that I felt like, oh, I'm asserting myself. He's answering questions in a way that make me feel good, which I feel like was part of the manipulation. And in that moment, he takes off his robe. This is Jeffrey Epstein, takes off his robe and he says, and dancers are comfortable with nudity. To which in my brain, that was the click. That was the click that if you said to me, what was the moment where if I had understood what was happening in my brain, I would have run out of there. But I didn't. That was the moment where all of my defenses went up. I got nervous. I got any trauma response in my body that was innate, absolutely acted. And I started thinking, I was like, well, nobody told me about nudity. My roommate didn't tell me about nudity. He didn't mention anything about nude. Like, I had no idea that that's what this was about. Right. And so it was that moment that I knew that something was wrong, but it seemed I was incapable of doing anything else except complying in that moment. So then it gets to me pulling my notebook out and me demonstrating all the things I learned to progressing to being raped. And where that moment switched was when he got angry at me. He got angry at me because I wasn't doing it right. And so there was a switch that flipped. And it was in that switch that I feel like complete dissociation, my body froze. And that is the moment where everything in my life changed going forward for the next 30 years. So I was raped July 9th, 1991 by Jeffrey Epstein. Stuck in a fight, flight, freeze, fawn trauma response for 30 years. Re-triggered when my hometown of Newtown, Connecticut experienced the elementary school shooting. And have spent the last 10 years focused on healing. And part of that healing is getting to the place of being able to discuss this and share what I've learned, share how I've healed, share what I've learned about witnessing trauma in Newtown and witnessing it in myself and all the things people don't want to talk about trauma.
Yes.
So that's like the long answer to your short question.
Oh, no. That was perfect. Thank you for sharing with us. I want to talk about something you and I have discussed previously, but after the assault, you had an experience with a friend of yours. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it was actually a really beautiful experience, kind of a missed moment that paid it forward 30 years later. So the day after I was assaulted, I was a scholarship student at Steps on Broadway in New York, and I went in to do my work study the next day, and my friend Joanne was there, and she said, "Hey, how are you doing? How'd it go with that job interview yesterday?" And I couldn't speak. And when she asked me, by the time she asked me a third time, "Hey, how are you doing? Are you okay?" And she could see the look on my face and I wasn't responding. She grabbed me by the hand, pulled me into the office where I just broke down into tears. And I told her a fraction of what happened because I was too humiliated to tell her the whole thing. And she said, without me even finishing, "Jessica, we need to go to the police." And I thought, who's going to believe a 22-year-old dancer over this wealthy Wall Street guy with a penthouse and a plane? And so I shut it down. I proceeded to not talk to my friend for another 30 years because I was too humiliated. And it was when I internalized all of that experience. However, Joanne actually did all the right things that we wish, you know, Kimberly, you and I have talked about, that we wish people understood now. She saw something wrong and she asked me about it. She believed me with very little information. She didn't need all the details. She knew what to do when I was too traumatized to even think straight. And she was willing to take me to the police in 1991, you know, when all we ever heard about was fight or flight back then. We didn't know about freeze. I didn't know that to freeze wasn't consent. So she was really brave, really assertive, really compassionate and empathetic, and she believed me. And it took 30 years for me to go back to that moment to recognize, wow, everybody should have that moment.
I love that she did that in a time where that wasn't the kind of information that you just readily have available. It's not something that you hop on social media and are checking out. But for her to have that intuition and just be able to help you the way that she did, even though at that time you didn't know that you needed that kind of help, is really prophetic.
It is. Like I said, I joke around with her now because I did reach out to her in the last couple of years, told her what I was going through, and we reconnected, and I was able to thank her. You know, one of the reasons I feel comfortable sharing my story now is because I had decided that if I was going to share my story, I needed to come forward, not just with the story, but with some kind of a solution, something different, some new way to look at this. And she became part of that solution. And so we reconnected and we got to talk and reminisce, and it was really beautiful. And I joke around with her that, yeah, you paid it forward 30 years.
So tell us now the difference in why you can talk about it openly, like the legalese behind why you're able to discuss this, whereas some of the other survivors can't yet.
I don't know if it's necessarily legally. because I was assaulted only once, it was by Jeffrey Epstein himself. It happened when I was an adult. I wasn't trafficked. I never met any of the other powerful men that want to suppress these survivors' stories or who threaten their lives on a regular basis. So my situation is very different in my ability to share my story. And that's why, you know, I had someone say, you don't have to say you're an Epstein survivor. And I said, no, I don't. You're right. I said, but I'm gonna, because I can. And do I protect the wealthy millionaire who rapes and traffics people? Do I do that? Should I do that? Should I be accommodating? And I thought, nope, I'm just going to keep pressing that button, Epstein, 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 so no one ever forgets that that's where it started. And that even though the Ghislaine Maxwell trial has ended, none of the men involved were ever found guilty for sex trafficking. And so do I talk about Epstein a lot? It's only to get you to hear me, because I know it's easier for you to hear me, for your audience to hear me, because it's Epstein. We all know this is a much bigger problem. And my therapist had a wonderful way of putting it. She was like, Jessica, it's the least he could do. It's the least he could do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think you hitting on why you're able to talk about this now really highlights something that I wanted to just bring attention to in your story. And it's that I did not hear you say that he told you at any point, don't tell anyone this, which is something that's very, very common in these stories of survivors who have been assaulted, is that there is some sort of power dynamic that's at play. And that's why you don't talk. It's not this very overt, don't tell anyone what happened. It's a little more insidious than that, right?
Yes.
It's who's going to believe me?
And one of the things, like in the therapy that I've been able to do, in a phenomenal trauma therapist, because I'm from Newtown, I have access to incredible therapies and modalities and humans that are just really well-versed in trauma. So one of the things we noticed in my therapy session, and when I've discussed this before, is that he knew I was frozen in fear. That was actually the power play. He knew, and he actually threw money on the table and told me to make an appointment next week. I think people don't want to look at the different ways that power plays. I joke around, it's like everything is a sex game, but it's not. It's a power play. It's what it is. It's all about the addiction to power being the turn on. It's funny because that was going to be one of my one like dark jokes in my talk that I got from a speaking coach. We were talking about how he drops his robe and I'm standing there and I'm staring at, you know, Jeffrey Epstein's penis. And all I could think of was like, there should not be any penises at job interviews.
I think that that's something that generally we don't experience.
We don't experience. Like, that should not happen.
Job interview. Okay.
There should not be a penis at a job interview, right? And
like, insert that into things I never thought I would say in my life. We shouldn't have to say this.
This shouldn't have to be a thing. This shouldn't be something that some man has maneuvered and manipulated in such a way that they could normalize whipping their penis out at a job interview. That is the level of manipulation we're talking about.
Yeah.
Because think about it, and this is what I am so astounded that people don't talk more about. They only talk about the sex trafficking. They don't talk about how Epstein manipulated grown-ass men out of their money for years. And so they want to blame teenagers who couldn't get out of that manipulation, but never want to look at the grown men, millionaires, who were manipulated out of their money. So can we focus a little on that?
Right. And how about the fact that he was influential and convincing enough to convince women to bring other women in?
That's what happened to me.
Yes, exactly. I don't know about you, but I am feeling extra stressed and I would like to not cut my bangs this time. So how are you currently dealing with your stress?
When I realized that I was going to be reliving my trauma on a very frequent basis, I realized that maybe I needed something to increase my stress resiliency. I was lucky enough to find Cured Nutrition. I unequivocally can say it's changed my life and how I deal with stress. I know that sounds dramatic, but Cured is a brand that is high quality. They are full of CBD, adaptogens, and functional mushrooms. All three of those go into your nervous system and they actually calm your nervous system. So you feel a little bit more like a freight liner in the ocean, not getting rocked by the waves, as opposed to a rowboat getting thrown all over the place. And my favorite, Kim got to try when she was here in South Carolina, are the gummies.
I loved it. And I didn't expect them to taste so good.
They're my favorite for when you're feeling a little extra stress on top of your day. Cured Serenity Gummies have CBD, just like all of the Cured products, but they also have ashwagandha and L-theanine. Together, those three go into your system and they just give you a nice, tranquil feeling.
I'm so excited to learn more about them and try more of their products now that you've got me hooked.
Yes. And for any of our listeners who would like to try Cured, you can go to curednutrition.com. That's C-U-R-E-D, nutrition.com. And you can use code KARA10 to get 10% off your purchase today. That's KARA10, curednutrition.com. Give them a try and let us know what you think.
Did your roommate knowingly put you in that situation, or did she have any grasp on what may happen? Was that happening to her sort of without disclosing anything about her? Was that knowledge there?
I would love to disclose stuff about her. Because I feel she is one of the recruiters that needs to be brought in. I have actually, that's the statement I gave to the FBI. In fact, the only reason I was part of the Victims Compensation Fund was because I reached out to lawyers to give them information about her.
Wow.
Okay. I didn't even think I had a claim. I wasn't even calling about myself because I thought, oh, statute of limitations, you know, whatever. Yeah. But I was trying to reach out to attorneys that had known Epstein victims. They had filed cases. So I reached out to lawyers and said, look, somebody needs to find this girl, because from what I understand and what I knew from a mutual friend of ours, my roommate had been working for him for up to 8 years, maybe more. So longer, like before Ghislaine Maxwell. Mm-hmm. Knew Ghislaine Maxwell and continued. So she knows as much as Ghislaine Maxwell did. And yet, no one's brought her in. She has not been brought in. None of the recruiters have been brought in.
I literally have goosebumps.
I know. Like, oh, and so when I'm sitting there telling the FBI, I call the FBI. Like I said, they asked us to call even after he was gone. They said, here, if you know anything about this, call. So I call and I say, 1991, I was raped by Jeffrey Epstein. This person is a person of interest you want to find. Mm-hmm. I got a call back from a detective who was on the sex task force in New York. And he's like, yeah, well, we have to call everybody back. But, you know, it was 30 years ago. I don't know what you want us to do with it. Those exact words. And I said, no. I'm not calling about me. I'm calling to tell you there's a person out there. And this was 6-9 months before Ghislaine Maxwell had been arrested. There's a person out there that knows just as much about all of this that no one is talking about. No one is going after. Her names are on the plane records. No one's going after her. No one's, well, okay. And it took me a year and a half to finally get Special Agent Amanda Young to reach out to me. After I was calling Southern District of New York every couple of weeks, they'd say, okay, well, I'll try to get this to you. If you don't hear from me 2 weeks, call back. That went on 3 times before he finally passed my information on to Special Agent Amanda Young, who reached out to me. We did a phone interview, and I said a lot of what I just told you, and I gave her very specific information about my roommate. And I said, I can't be the first person telling you about her. She was like his right-hand person. She was buddies with Ghislaine Maxwell. And yet I've seen her name nowhere. I've seen nobody talking about her. You know, do you know who I'm talking about? Do you have her? Because I'm thinking maybe they already have her and they're going to put her up on the stand against Ghislaine Maxwell. And she said, I can't tell you that. But what I have to tell you legally is that your victim statement will be part of the prosecution's case against Ghislaine Maxwell. We will have to use your real name but we will red act anyway for anyone to identify you. And we will wait as long as possible before we present all of the victim statements to the defense, because I don't know if you recall that during the Ghislaine Maxwell, not just the trial, but all the pre-trial stuff, they were trying to get all of the victims' names released, all of the victim statements' names released. And so what was interesting, though, after the fact, and this is something that I've been talking to a journalist in the UK who's writing a story about the Ghislaine Maxwell, she checked the records and my victim statement was not used.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not going to jump to conclusions or anything like that. Tell us your thoughts as to why that may be.
Well, I think it's pretty obvious to everyone that wants to still continue talking about this case, which thank you so much for having me, is that besides the trauma and damage that is done, I think what needs to be discussed is there's a lot of covering up going on right now, that everyone thinks they can wrap up this case in a nice little bow with Ghislaine Maxwell and people will stop talking about it. In fact, I've had someone that is an executive producer in the media who's like, yeah, that's old news cycle. Nobody cares. Nobody cares anymore, without recognizing that they did one thing. They got Ghislaine Maxwell, which is important. So important. But it is one tiny fraction of the actual network that is happening out there. And, you know, part of me wonders, did I actually talk to Amanda Young? Did I actually talk to Amanda Young, or did I talk to somebody else that was posing as Amanda Young? I don't know.
Gosh, I have to tell you. So this entire just saga of the Jeffrey Epstein story, my husband and I don't go down a lot of rabbit holes when it comes to true crime, but this is one that my husband and I both worked in law enforcement. My husband did a lot of federal work for the government. He has done a lot of different things. And this is one that just boggled our brain, because you didn't hear anything about it until you heard about it. And then you only heard little bits and just the continuous cover up happening. And I just think, as a victim myself, what that must feel like, that not, you know, one of the things Kim and I say often is you can't necessarily hang your hat of healing on the justice system. You're going to be let down. I hate to put it in such a black and white, like blunt way, but that's kind of the case. However, as a victim, it must feel to these, I would say hundreds at least, right, of women.
Minimum.
It just must feel so powerless and heartbreaking that no one wants to listen. And it would probably feel like no one cares. And it just breaks my heart.
It's cultural gaslighting.
Oh, yes.
You have all of these tons of people that are like compounding on you saying, no, not a relevant news cycle anymore. You should stop talking about this, over and over and over.
Yet there's so many of you, and even you are dissuaded from speaking out about it because you know there is that implied threat. No one's telling you you can't say it, but you know better. You know why.
Yeah. And, you know, my concern and my thoughts always go to those survivors that can't say anything. So for me, I kind of feel like, you know what? I don't know who any of these people are. So I'm going to speak out, not just for me, but for all the people that Epstein survivors that can't, and keep people talking about this, because the rabbit holes are deep and wide and multiple, and it touches on so many different areas of politics, Hollywood, education systems, where he tried to get his hands into philanthropy and science. I mean, it touches so many areas of our country and the world, and it's ridiculous that nothing else has been done. And the only reason he was ever brought to justice was because of a journalist, Julie K. Brown. She wrote the piece called Perversion of Justice. And, you know, that moment, I'm sitting at home, 2018, sitting at home, I had just finished a meeting and I was eating lunch and I'm scrolling through my phone. And all of a sudden, for the first time, I see his face on my phone. And I start hyperventilating because I didn't necessarily recall his name. It wasn't until, so I happened to save my 1991 day planner, and that's how I was able to go back and confirm it. So I have my 1991 day planner. I saved all of that because I was a big journaler and I didn't get a chance to necessarily keep journal notes and everything, but I kept my day planner so I can remember my auditions and and all that. So I'm sitting there and I'm scrolling through my phone and I see his face. And in seeing his face, I start to hyperventilate. And I start to read a little bit about what Julie K. Brown is sharing. And then I have to stop. I call my therapist and she said, don't read it. Don't read it right now. So I just cry for 24 hours. And I wake up in the morning and I say, no, I'm going to read it. And I have to tell you, and I'm guessing you guys will understand this. There was a moment where I'm reading it and I'm going, oh my God, I wasn't the only one. It was not my fault. And it was such a release and a level of confidence came back into my being that I didn't know I had lost, a weight that I had been carrying that I had no idea I'd been carrying. Because for me, when I froze, I instantly believed, you're so stupid. How could you just lay there and do nothing? And when I put that on myself, I believed I can no longer trust myself and I can't even trust myself to keep myself safe. And that triggered a dissociation for me. The event triggered it and the internalization triggered it. And it was like the event was pulled. The way I describe it is kind of like it's pulled to the back of my brain inside this steel locker. And there's a sign on the door. I can't see the event, but it says, you're so stupid. And this is why. And so in that moment that I'm reading Julie K. Brown's article and I'm recognizing, no, I wasn't stupid. I wasn't. I'm not the only one. I thought the whole time I was the only one, the only person that this had ever happened to. And so it was very freeing. When I learned, the second big freeing moment was that freeze is a normal trauma, like a very natural response to the body feeling vulnerable and threatened. And it activates automatically and involuntarily without your awareness. Those two things completely changed my life. Completely. Had no idea how much I had been carrying around, how much it influenced my emotional, mental, physical, intellectual health, how much that had been debilitating, that holding on to that event unconsciously, how it had affected my career, my personal relationships, my romantic relationships. It was so devastating. And people want to believe that that event happens in a vacuum, one time, bam, you're done, just get over it. But they don't understand the debilitating effects that last for decades until you can actually look at that event and reprocess exactly what happened.
Yeah. One of the things that I heard you say earlier, and I just want to highlight because this is something that's so important to us, is that you said you didn't share your story until you had a solution. And so you had this solution-based means to share. And it sounds to me like you started to share because you had felt like you were alone, which is a very, very common thing that we hear when we talk to people who the first time they share out loud, they have this moment where they go, I'm not crazy. I'm not alone.
Yes.
And that's, you know, that's why Kim and I do what we do, is because we want people to realize you are not crazy. You are not alone in this. And so it sounds like that was kind of your impetus for sharing.
Yep.
Well, it's also important to point out that what makes you and this experience so unique, or at least one of the parts, is that you weren't alone. There are a ton of you that were victimized on this same level. The difference is there were those that were positioned above you to bring you into this. And, you know, just like your roommate, it's basically a pyramid scheme. You know, we're used to seeing really bad leggings being sold by girl bosses, but this is of sexual exploitation and victimization.
It's the ultimate pyramid scheme. And I know she had to, from what I learned from my lawyer, I was one of the oldest, farthest back. There was another person from the 1980s, there was someone from 1990, but I was like in the top three of the oldest allegations that they had. But then nobody else. What gave me the idea to even start talking about this a little bit more was because the Adult Survivors Act just went into effect in New York, November 24th, 2022. So survivors have a year. And not only do they have a year to sue individual people, but they can actually sue organizations and companies that have protected abusers. So I wanted to just put it out there to any survivors that happen to know my roommate, who was a professional dancer, early 20s. She was tall, 5'8", blonde, blue-eyed. She frequented Steps on Broadway, Broadway Dance Center, David Howard when it was functioning. It's closed now. She was a regular at Maggie Black Studio, but she was a professional dancer that I know recruited other professional dancers in the 90s. I'm sure of it. I know I wasn't the only one. I know she tried to recruit another friend of ours, so I know she didn't stop at the two of us. That's obviously what we know about Epstein, is this was a pattern of behavior. And from what I understand, she worked for him for a minimum of 8 years. So this is someone that was a ballet dancer, jazz dancer, who was out there in the world, all of the 90s recruiting people. And we don't hear about the 90s survivors of Jeffrey Epstein's. And so I'd like to encourage anyone that may have been brought to Jeffrey Epstein in the 90s, any dancers, through this woman, who was an adult at the time, to feel free to reach out to me, to feel free to seek out legal representation. And I don't want those survivors that are out there to think that they are alone, even if it just happened once, if it doesn't look like the typical Epstein path of having been a teenager and trafficked. It happened once to me, and it was devastating, and it deserves some restorative justice. An acknowledgement, just acknowledgement, because that's where the healing begins, right? That we all know. Once we actually acknowledge something like that did happen, it was never our fault, that's when the healing can begin. If there are people that are out there that are feeling alone and by themselves and that they can't do this, I'm there to tell them that I did. So I'm here. And if you need support, you can definitely feel free to reach out, because I don't think that this all ended with Ghislaine Maxwell being arrested. There are still survivors out there, and there are still humans that were part of this whole pyramid scheme. And those people still need to be held accountable.
You said that you want to share with a purpose. One of the things that I heard you say is you wanted to save your sharing of your story for when you had a solution. And it sounds to me like that moment where you saw his face, you said you felt like, maybe I'm not crazy and maybe I'm not alone. And I think that's a very common thing that we hear when we hear these survivor stories, is at some point, you feel isolated. You feel like you're crazy. You feel like you maybe are the only one. And that's one of the reasons that we want to share these stories, is so that people feel like they're not alone. And so I think that you have a pretty big call to action, because you don't want other people to feel like they're not alone. Is that safe to say?
Yes. And yes, that was very well said. So one of the things that happened for me that what I believe accelerated my healing was going through the Sandy Hook elementary school shooting in my hometown, where I first had to fall completely apart before I could start to be put back together again. And as I started to look at how people respond to mass tragedies and the amount of support, I mean, the global support we received in our town was insane. There's very few people that I come across that don't say, I remember exactly where I was when I heard the news. And so I started to analyze, after going through my own experience working for one of the foundations. I worked for Dylan's Wings of Change on a program called Wingman, where what we were doing was trying to inspire empathy, connection, and inclusion in young people. And so really, really focusing on community. And so watching these parents, how some of them were able to take their tragedy and turn it into a purpose, and not only a purpose, but really focused on strengthening community. And after watching, you know, kids that I taught as a dance teacher, how much even just teaching dance classes and them having the opportunity to come to dance classes, how healing that was. And then the difference between how people respond to sexual assault and sexual assault survivors. And having both of those situations, which for me, there were two national tragedies, international tragedies, and both were looked at differently from the survivor's perspective. People are still blaming survivors. People are still shaming survivors. They believe us to a degree, but it's still quantified and qualified based on our story. and based on what kind of details we give. Not just in the fact that Jeffrey Epstein always had manipulative intentions. It's never put on the predator. It's always put on the survivor. And that doesn't happen in other mass tragedies. So I started really thinking about that. And then I realized that in Sandy Hook, after Sandy Hook, we have active shooter drills in every single school in the country. After 9/11, we have airport security in every airport in the country. And as children, even at five, we're taught, hey, if a fire breaks out, here's where the fire alarm is. And if you happen to catch fire, we all know to stop, drop, and roll. We're taught that at 5 years old. And yet we're all more likely, and our children are more likely to experience sexual assault, sexual abuse, harassment, harm, than ever be in a school with an active shooter, on a plane with a terrorist, or even being in a burning building. And yet we are so afraid to ever discuss this as an idea of preparation. And yet we're not afraid of car seats or seat belts. And yet the only reason those two things save lives is if there's an actual accident. What I'm suggesting, and what I have now founded and am in the process of developing, is a program where we start to strategize and discuss, have all the language for discussing, look, hey, if this happens, this is how we solve it. We solve it as in a community. We create small little communities. We find three reliable people, like my friend Joanne, who didn't need, you know, much information, but she believed me. She saw something wrong. She knew what to do when I was too traumatized to even think about it. And she had the courage to say, hey, I'm going to go to the police station with you. So we plan ahead. We as parents, we as educators, talk to our kids about this. We make plans with our kids. Hey, if something happens, we're going to do A, B, and C. And basically, it's really simple, actually. All of us, any of us, can do a little that actually has a really impactful result. We can really focus on what the survivor needs without having all the details. We can start by believing without a lot of the details. We can make sure they are safe emotionally and physically without having all the details. And so my plan is basically something that I believe all parents should go through, and parents should then be working with their children, or let us work with your children, is sexual assault first responder training. And that will include not only finding your three people, your three Joannes or three J's, because this happens to boys too. This happens in the LGBTQ non-binary communities at inordinate percentages. And so we talk about what happens in your brain when you're sexually assaulted, and how it's impossible to make decisions afterwards, and what are the options that we have. And we talk about an emergency response plan, a strategy now. And what I believe that's going to happen if we start talking about this now and start creating strategies now is a couple of things. One, I think from my experience, I think we're going to be less likely to freeze in the moment because we've had conversations around this, because we are discussing ways to look out for predators and predatory sexual behavior. I think that when humans with predatory sexual behavior learn that we are now planning and have strategies in place already, that within 24 hours, three people are going to know about any questionable sexually harmful behavior. It's not ever going to be a secret again. We've already set it up for resilience, for healing. We've already set ourselves up to know exactly what we want to do. I think that's going to be the deterrent and the prevention that we've been actually looking for.
I think that's amazing. And that is the kind of proactive planning that we don't see. It's not readily available.
And isn't it funny, you know, going back to car seats and seatbelts, this is actually one of the analogies I've been thinking a lot about. You know, there's no one running around saying, yeah, well, we're trying to prevent car accidents, you know, but not allowing us to have seatbelts.
It's like, we can't prevent cars from running into one another, so we don't know what to do.
Yeah.
We can't prevent someone from falling asleep at the wheel or driving drunk. You know, we can have laws against it, but we can't prevent it. And sometimes it just happens. So what are you going to do? Exactly. Right. You're so right.
Exactly. And yes.
Why can't we have some seatbelts?
Yeah. And now it's like click it or ticket, you know, and you have to have your car seat positioned in a certain way to prevent horrific damage. But it's as if they go, well, we're trying to prevent it. If it happens to you, sorry, you're on your own. And not only are you on your own, you have to go outside your community, reach out to strangers and try to get help. I didn't do that. I even had somebody right there and I didn't necessarily pay attention because I didn't understand the freeze response. But if we understood that ahead of time, we understand like it's normal to freeze. It's normal to fawn, appease, all of those things. People think it's the gray area. No, your body naturally does it to preserve the organism. It's actually a really, really good brain strategy in dangerous situations. And so when people start to understand those things, they start to look out for them and be aware of them. That's how we then prevent. So we actually have to deal with the people that have gone through it already before we can say, yeah, let's not ignore this problem and just try to work on prevention. Because even bystander and ally training is expecting one courageous person to stand up against their whole community to do something. And I'm not saying those things aren't important. Please don't misunderstand me. And I'm not saying that all the preventative measures aren't important. I'm saying we're not facing the volume that this actually happens in. And so what is one of the most common symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder? Memory loss.
Yep.
We have a study that we found that after a year, 49% of the sexual assault survivors that participated in this study exhibited symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. 49%. And that is 17% higher than other issues, which the next highest issue is domestic violence, all higher than even veterans. But when people talk about post-traumatic stress disorder, they only think about veterans, or they assume it's mass shootings. Do you know, even in mass shootings, that's in the single digits, 49%. And so how do we change that number? It's not going to be just in prevention. It's how do we provide seatbelts and car seats and talk about prevention? Because I know you don't look at a car seat and get freaked out. It doesn't scare you. No, you think I'm doing everything I can to protect my child. I'm being proactive and I'm being preventative because I can't guarantee there's not going to be a car accident. But if there is, I feel as empowered as I can be in this decision to use this car seat. But for sexual violence, we're like, well, let's just leave everybody to their own and wing it.
I love that. And I think that's such a good idea. And it's so unique. It's not something that I've heard a lot of talk around. There are programs that work on prevention of your children being targeted online, you know, online safety. But really, our children are the most at danger from people that they're around regularly that are actually in their real lives. And so it's a struggle to consider how do we even address this? You know, we can lay the groundwork, which I think we've talked about before with our children of, you know, using proper anatomical terms and this is what's okay and this is what's not. And I think that that's something that's very commonplace. But then a lot of the other knowledge that we have afterward is on what happens afterwards. So I love that this is something that kind of bridges that gap and that in between. So for people that are hearing this, they're like, I love this idea. How do I find out more about this program and this information? Because I want it. I want it. Kim wants it. You know, our listeners are going to be like, I want to know. So how do they get more information about this?
Thank you so much. So I just did a TED Talk in Folsom, California on January 21st. It was amazing, where I talk all about this idea we're spreading. And the free app version came out then. We are launching the live online workshops that are 2 hours. So we recommend parents and educators, come take a 2-hour course with us so that we can teach you how to be a sexual assault first responder, which really just means how to be a good human. And we teach you how to make a plan that is simple, easy, accessible to everyone. We give language for different age groups so that you will know how to talk to an elementary school child, you will know how to talk to a middle school child, you will know how to talk to a teenager. And the goal of what I wanted to do with this concept of three Joannes, having three J's, three people that you have planned with, made a pact with, is that I want to circumvent that moment where survivors internalize all of that trauma. Because that's where the long-term trauma happens. It's not just in the actual event. It's how we internalize it. And then with sexual violence, as you guys know, it becomes tenfold because of the negative community response that we can receive, which further isolates us. And so I wanted to stop that moment, because what I know and have learned after Sandy Hook is that early intervention is key in preventing long-term trauma. So picture this. So now we're stopping that moment in its tracks. That survivor is surrounded by three trustworthy, supportive, safe companions. Now, maybe that nervous system does not ever become as dysregulated as it did, say for me, where it got bottled up for 30 years. And maybe now details are remembered far more easily which means potentially more justice. And I have within 24 hours, three people that can be my outcry witnesses.
Gosh, this is just such a great approach because as simple as it is, it really takes all of the shame and the stigma that sexual violence continuously proliferates and sort of smashes that. And I love that it's such an approach that anyone can take, anyone can be prepared for. And the more that we do that and build upon it, it just seems like it goes hand in hand with, you know, you hear me talk about the Start by Believing program within Violence Against Women International. And I love how those two things can work hand in hand. Now, EVA is a nonprofit, and I know that you've got a really big call to action here, but tell us a little bit about what the difference is from nonprofit to what you're doing.
So one of the things that I knew that I wanted to do when I was creating this revolutionary safety strategy app for sexual violence was I wanted to do it as a for-profit. And the reason for that is that there are so many incredible organizations on the nonprofit level already down there in the trenches doing the work. And I didn't want to, A, pull any grant money from them, because I know how hard that is. After having worked for a nonprofit for 5 years, Dylan's Wings of Change, I know how hard it is financially as a nonprofit. And I kind of had this vision that I would create a for-profit company that had the transparency and social justice function of a nonprofit. But because it was a for-profit, I'm going to be able to take a percentage of those sales and direct them to the struggling nonprofits that are already doing fabulous and amazing work. And so that felt really important to me, to stick with my entrepreneurial, within my level of understanding. Nonprofits are not my level of understanding, but do what I know and create a conscientious and thoughtful and socially good for-profit company.
And it's kind of challenging my thinking too on projects that I just have going on where I'm like, because the world of nonprofits is just like so foreign to me. And I'm just like, so daunting. I don't even know how to begin to do that. So yeah. That's awesome. I love that idea.
And what I also believe does is, you had said that my app and this strategy will fill a gap. I'm actually hoping that my for-profit will fill a gap, because as my team and I have been talking about and discussing for the last year, there are people on the ground doing really good work, but nobody knows about them. So what if 3Js, 3Joannes, that workshop, that training is actually the touch point that gets people aware and understanding all of the options that are available to them on the local level? And so we're just a pointer. We're a pointer to services. We're a pointer to training and options. And we're able to do that on the for-profit level. So we're going to be able to financially point to all of these other people that are doing such amazing work now already and have been.
Okay. So for anyone who wants to reach out to you, they want to follow you, they want to know about what you're doing, how can they do that? What's the best way for them to follow you?
You can go to my website, jessmichaelspeaks.com. I haven't been on social media much, but I'm gearing up for more in 2023. So I think the best place to find me is TikTok. That's where I'll be spending a lot of time, just because I've also just freaking loved TikTok University.
Yes.
I mean, it's amazing. I've learned so much. Everything from recipes to trauma healing. I mean, you really get it all.
Mm-hmm. It is such a lovely place. You know, that's where Kim and I's friendship stems from. And both of us on our phone still have Kimberly Corbin TikTok, Kara yep. Chamberlain TikTok, like as our contacts for one another. So we are Aww. Big fans. We're big fans of the tickety talk here. So. All right, our closing question. This is our question because we are Survivor's Guide to True Crime that we ask all of our guests. So we have to know, do you consume true crime as a survivor of true crime yourself?
I actually really love true crime.
This is one.
Yeah. Oh.
Okay, really? Tell us, are there kinds that you do like / don't like?
I like psychological thrillers because I actually try to figure out the story before it comes to an end. Mm. So I actually watch, say, a show and try to solve it faster than the people.
I do that too. I did that with my
Do you do that?
And I always, like, it's this thing between my husband and I where he's like, how do you always figure these out? I'm like, I'm so smart. Like, I was texting him while I was watching Wednesday and I was like, it's totally Christina Ricci's character. I was like, it's her. I'm like halfway through the season. I'm like, she's the bad guy. Oh, sorry. Spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't seen it.
I have it right now. It's been out long enough. It's the, what is it? The Marvel clause.
Yeah. Where it's like, if you haven't seen it by now, sorry. But and so like when it turned out to be her, I was like, I was right. I'm with you on those kind of things. I'm like, I just want to know and figure it out.
But I'm not, you know, when you say true crime, I really struggle with doing too much in the just focusing on the trauma part. I have to limit my trauma consumption.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
But if they focus on the police and the detectives and all of the fun ways to figure stuff out.
Catch them.
Yeah.
It's like the Nancy Drew effect,
yes,
right? Where you're like, I want to solve this mystery. So, yeah.
And I would have gotten away with it too if it wasn't for those damn kids.
The meddling kids.
Yeah.
Scooby-Doo, Nancy Drew. Every day, you know, Kim actually has Scooby-Doo over there. She actually has Scooby-Doo in her house with her.
So I have a Scooby-Doo that's scared of hardwood floors.
He is Scooby-Doo, I think. Or he's a little Marmaduke-ish, I think.
And his human voice has a lisp, so he's stout with a TH.
It's like that meme. Have you ever seen that meme with that like really ugly dog where it's like, I told them at Starbucks my name was Steven with a PH. Steven. We'll send it to you. This is like all the time you're like, Steven.
Say that.
All right. And on that note, this has been Survivor's Guide to True Crime with Jess Michaels. And we are so glad that you joined us today. It's just truly been a pleasure. And we look forward to continuing these conversations and our friendship and the community building aspect of what it means to be a survivor of true crime.
Yes, we love you, Jess, and we're so proud of everything that you've already accomplished. Can't wait to see what more you're going to do.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. You guys are awesome. I'm very excited to be part of this little club.
Yay! It's the club. We've got jackets.
Yes. I want a jacket. I want a jacket.
We're working on it.
Survivor's Guide to True Crime is hosted and executive produced by Kimberly Corbin Rourke and Kara Robinson Chamberlain. If you love what we do here, please don't forget to follow, rate, and review the show in your podcast player. It's an easy and free way to help us and help more people find the show.
To learn more about the guests featured or to find resources and information discussed on the show, visit survivorsguidetotruecrime.com.
Thanks for listening.
Well, see you later.
Starting this week, Survivor's Guide to True Crime is on Patreon. Join Kim and Kara's captive audience to get more exclusive content, bonus episodes, live Q&As, and content like this.
That is the level of manipulation we're talking about.
Yeah.
While we're on the topic of penises. This will be for Patreon.
Listening.
I was on the Steve Wilkos show. I was sending them a bunch of old news articles and photographs and evidence and all kinds of things. And I come across these pictures because, you know, these are the normal things that I have in my house. And one of them, he had of himself with his face covered, pleasuring himself, holding literally a picture of a penis. I'm like, something looks off. Did he only have one ball?
For more information and to join Kim and Kara's captive audience on Patreon, visit survivorsguidetotruecrime.com.